From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.
It took a little longer than we thought, but we did it.
That's Pennsylvania Democrat Connor Lamb declaring victory after midnight last night with a razor-thin lead over Republican Rick Saccone in a special election for a U.S. House seat that is still too close to call. Saccone said he won't concede until officials finish the vote count. Even as close as it is, the results are seen as a victory for a Democrat in a district that President Trump carried by nearly 20 points in 2016. Joining us now is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Jeremy.
And your thoughts on this? This is a district that favors Republicans so much that no Democrat even ran in 2014 and 2016.
That's right. And a Republican has held this district, I think, has won in the last eight elections. But this is a big triumph for Democrats, and it shows that they can win even in reliably red districts. Donald Trump was fairly popular in this district. His approval rating was a little bit higher than it is in the rest of the country. But Democrats now have a template. If they run a candidate that suits the district, like Connor Lamb did, he was a Marine, he was a former prosecutor, he was pro-union, he agreed with Donald Trump on a lot of things, on guns and abortion and tariffs, and even on Nancy Pelosi, they can win. And this is just good news for Democrats, bad news for Republicans, even if Saccone had been able to eke it out with 1 or 2 points.
And what about President Trump? How much of this was about President Trump's popularity?
Well, you know, all midterm elections are considered to be referendums on the party in power and the president. And Republicans are saying that Trump actually helped Saccone. Saccone would have lost by a bigger margin, that Donald Trump's visits and his popularity in the district actually helped close the gap. That'll be debated. But I think the real tell is how few Republican candidates want him to campaign with them. I can't remember if it was AP or who it was, but they went to every single Republican running in a district that Hillary carried, which, of course, is where the Democrats hope to get back the majority. They went to all of those 23 Republicans, and I think only one or two of them said that they would be happy for the president to campaign with them. So it tells you that Trump is an anchor on Republicans, not a boost.
And what's the message for Democrats going into the midterms?
I think the message for Democrats is they've got to have candidates that fit their districts. If it's a more conservative district, you're going to get a more conservative Democratic candidate. That's why parties are big tents. But the message also is that there are at least 100 other House districts where Trump won by less, by fewer points than he won this district by. In other words, that should be easier for Democrats to get. This one was pretty hard. So it shows you if they can win here, they should be able to win in those more suburban districts that have that either Hillary won or Donald Trump won by a lot less than he won Pennsylvania 18.
And maybe take back the House and maybe even have some good competition in the Senate.
Well, I agree with the first one. I disagree with the second one. The House is in play. Democrats have a chance to get the House back. I think the Senate map is still very daunting for Democrats. I think they could actually end up losing seats. They could pick up a couple and lose some. When I talk to Democrats, they say that their definition of victory in the Senate is to come out net, net, net the same. In other words, if they picked up two and lost two and they ended up with the same kind of 51-49 split, they'd be thrilled. The Senate is just much harder. There are Democratic incumbent senators in red states. There are at least five of them where Donald Trump won by huge margins. And that's just going to be very hard.
Mar, just a few seconds here, but we're just a day away from what happened yesterday, which was the firing of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. And some are saying that there are more firings on the way this week. Are you expecting that?
I don't know about this week, but Donald Trump himself, and he's a very transparent guy, he said yesterday he's very close to having the cabinet that he wants and other things. So, yes, I think there will be more personnel changes. Exactly when they happen, I'm not sure.
Mara Liasson, NPR national political correspondent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to those massive student walkouts today. CNN's sound of young people chanting against the NRA at the White House as students across the country marked 1 month since 17 people were killed in a school shooting in Parkland, Florida. It was an awakening for many students, including Zach Hipschman. He is a junior at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High. He was there that day. Two friends were killed. He recently co-founded the group Parents Promise to Kids, a downloadable contract parents can sign, a pledge they can make. Zach joins us now. And Zach, that day you were sitting in a closet with others. You could hear the shooter. I'm imagining those memories are still here.
It never goes away from you. It's always that little chunk in your heart. But it does subside and it does fizzle out over time. And I never want it to ever happen to anyone again, because what I experienced that day was just on a whole nother level of just being scared and not knowing what to do, and just the fear of the unknown was overpowering. Mm-hmm. So we're fighting so that it will never happen again.
And so you've got this Parents Promise to Kids, Grandparents Promise to Kids. There's a general promise contract that mm-hmm. people can download, and we'll give them information about that. But what's the promise?
The promise is children under 18 obviously cannot vote, and child obviously won, change laws. But since they can't vote on that yet, they have their parents promise them that they'll vote for legislators and politicians who put the safety of children over guns.
Well, here's the deal. That mm-hmm. means different things to different people. Now, you know, the marchers mm-hmm. today are asking for a ban on assault weapons, universal background checks before gun sales. So they're asking for these very specific things. You're not. Now, for someone, safety before guns might mean armed teachers. For someone else, it might mean guns banned from school grounds. Why did you leave it wide open like that?
We wanted the concept to be simple. I know you can interpret it in a lot of different ways, but our whole main objective is for people to put the safety of children over guns and over money. We don't want politicians taking money and supporting the NRA, who is not going to put child safety over guns.
Well, and as you know, they say they do by, mm-hmm. for instance, having more guns in school. So it starts going round right. and round. I'm wondering, too, if you wanted to leave it a little wider open, because I'm wondering if you've watched some of your friends, Sarah Chadwick, mm-hmm. for instance,
yeah.
And there's Delaney Tarr, who mm-hmm. have gotten into real battles
right.
with right-wing commentators, right. with conspiracy theorists. Laura Ingraham, one of the right-wing commentators, chided Sarah Chadwick for saying something like, we should change the name of AR-15s to Marco Rubio because they're so easy to buy, you know, implying that
right.
politicians were easy to buy. And you start getting into that kind of back and forth, it can get pretty nasty pretty fast.
100%.
Yeah.
I know that a lot of people are making this about red and blue. We're getting too into the political aspect. And we're fighting here for our safety. I feel like we're getting too much into, hey, let's start bashing politicians. Hey, let's start fighting with people on Twitter.
Well, but I guess my point is that you may not think you're, getting involved with politicians, but you can't help it, you know, if you start putting opinions about gun control on
right.
social media. And by the way, does it bother you at all? A lot of people don't know that this march is produced by an arm of the Women's March, which somebody sees, you know, political. It came up in response to President Trump's inauguration and his comments
right.
about women. Do you have friends who are saying, there's no room for me in this? My family has guns and we hunt.
You know, I haven't heard anyone say that, but if they do, my response would be, please stop making this about red and blue for the love of whatever. I mean, come on now. People think that we're trying to make their guns go away, but that's not true. It's just there has to be regulations to stop a 19-year-old psychopath from getting an AR-15, a mass killing device that killed 17 and could have killed a lot more at my school.
By the way, you wrote in your very poignant post, you knew Nick Cruz. You watched him, mm-hmm. you know, what, break glass or when he was a
right.
kid?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's been suspended for hurting animals, for breaking glass at the middle school. He's just always been a bad kid, but somehow he was able to purchase a weapon, and I don't think that should be allowed.
Yeah. I'm imagining that what has happened to you, there's a loss of innocence, a loss of childhood. I mean, how would you describe
I'd say there's a loss of a feeling of safety and protection, because I just feel like every time I hear a trunk slam, it raises my awareness. Every time I see someone a little bit weird walking into my school, it makes me wake up. It's just stuff like that that didn't affect me before is now scaring me a little bit in public, and that's just nothing I can change about that. It just time has to heal, but stuff like that is making me more aware, more than ever.
Zach Hipschman, a junior at Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High, will link you up to his contracts at hearnow.org. Zach, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Gina Haspel, President Trump's nominee to become the new CIA chief, has come under fire for her role reportedly running a secret prison in Thailand where terrorism suspects were waterboarded. Some of the men detained at the so-called Black Site ended up at Guantanamo Bay. Well, one of them was the Saudi man accused of masterminding the 2000 bombing of the USS Cole, which killed 17 American sailors and injured 39. Well, there have been major developments in his trial before a military tribunal at Guantanamo. And joining us for more on that is Carol Rosenberg of the Miami Herald. And Carol, we knew the developments. The lawyers in the USS Cole case quit, but we didn't know why, because it was shrouded in all this secrecy by the judge. You broke the story last week that they quit because they found a listening device?
In fact, they did. They spotted a microphone on August 2nd or August 3rd inside the meeting site that had been set up for this man, Abdulrahim al-Nashri, a Saudi, to meet with his lawyers in what was supposed to be these confidential attorney-client meetings. And, you know, they called me up in October and told me that they were quitting the case, but they couldn't tell me why.
Well, we'll talk about this. Why was this shrouded in secrecy?
So it turns out this microphone and this system was classified. The judge has no ability to change classification. So the judge inherited a situation where the prosecutors told him that the system was classified, and therefore the judge couldn't talk about it, the defense attorneys couldn't talk about it, and all of the filings and all of the circumstances of these men and women quitting the case were classified. And so the attorneys for this man, Abdulrahim al-Nashri, there were three civilian attorneys. They concluded that they had an ethical problem. They consulted an ethicist and they quit the case. And one of the things they had asked the judge was permission to tell their client, we saw a microphone. And what the judge had told them is, no, it's classified. Mm-hmm. That man, who was held for years in CIA custody and knows all sorts of national security secrets, including what was done to him by the CIA, including the circumstances of his waterboarding, he wasn't allowed to know that there was a microphone in his meeting room.
And that's why the lawyers quit. So how were you able to write about this?
Well, it was a hard story to write about. The lawyers who had been talking to me for years were, I think, aching to tell me. And then recently, a document came my way. Still unclear to me whether it's unclassified in its entirety, but it lays out the circumstances of them finding this microphone. And for the first time that I believe the attorneys are aware of, it says the microphone was disconnected, that it was not part of a system that was listening in, that they now say in this document that it was a legacy microphone. And they claim that it wasn't plugged in. The problem is, they also claim in this document that after the attorneys quit, they went in and dismantled the whole thing and carried it off. So if those lawyers are now allowed to talk about the microphone, they aren't allowed to investigate, which was the thing they wanted to do in the first place. Because, as I think you might know, years before, the same thing had happened in a different site where the 9/11 lawyers for the alleged plotters of the 9/11 attack were meeting with their clients. And they looked up in the ceiling and they saw something that looked like a smoke detector.
Smoke detector, right.
And it contained a listening device.
But hold up there. Let's talk about that case back in 2012, because we want to hear more about the current case. But back then, a military judge let lawyers question defense officials in court about this listening device that they found in a smoke detector.
Totally different set of circumstances, which I also think is what led the U.S.'s cold defense attorneys to quit. Different judge, a different time. Back when they found it in the 9/11 case, the judge then allowed for a full open court hearing, discovery. They brought in people from the prison. They described the system, and they said the same thing back then. It was a legacy microphone left over from earlier interrogations, and it wasn't turned on. And the whole thing was explored. And whether or not the defense attorneys for the men accused of the 9/11 attacks believe them, it's now part of the record. So if they're ever convicted and sentenced to death, the lawyers in that case can make that part of their appeal on the death sentence. In the instance of the USS Cole bombing case, this man who's accused of masterminding that, his judge was further along, determined to go to trial, and for whatever reason, the Air Force colonel, who's the judge in the Cole case, said, no investigation. The other thing that's sort of intriguing about this is in any other court, lawyers of record who want to quit would have to go before the judge and get permission. In this instance, a general who is their supervisor, the chief defense counsel, released them. So they never went back to Guantanamo. They quit one day and they never went back. So for the past 5 months, this judge has been trying to get this thing on track. And out of this, let's say, vacuum comes this unclassified, declassified account that it was a microphone.
That you received.
That was filed in an appeals court and that I received, yes.
Yeah. So it's declassified. So what's all the fuss about how nobody could talk about the microphone because it's classified?
That's what I want to know. If it was such a secret 5 months ago, how come it's not a secret now? You know, I asked the Pentagon about the microphone, and they said systems at the prison are classified. I asked the CIA about the microphone, and they just got back to me and said it's not ours. And so what's the big secret, and why did it take so long, and why is it stuck on the microphone? We don't know, except that one judge handled it very differently than the other one.
So meanwhile, what happens with this USS Cole case? No lawyers. Can they hire new lawyers?
The big problem with this case is it's a death penalty case. So if you want to execute someone in the United States, the accused is entitled to what they call a learned counsel, someone with extensive experience in defending death penalty cases. And there aren't that many of them, and there are very few of them in the military. So it's stuck on the death penalty defender has walked out. The judge would like to compel him to come back. He's refusing to follow his orders. And I think what happened when he walked off the bench the other day is he realized this has to be resolved. Mm. They need a death penalty defender. And so the USS Cole case is at a full stop until some other court decides how he can go forward.
And as you said, the families of 17 killed are, you know, waiting to once again to see what will happen. Quick question, Carol Rosenberg. Is there any feeling that those conversations were being recorded, that it wasn't some turned-off legacy microphone left over?
The defense attorneys are suspicious of everything involving these cases, in no small part because the men accused in these death cases spent 3 and 4 years in the black sites of the CIA. They were waterboarded. They were kept nude. They were sleep deprived. They were abused in ways that is described as sexual abuse. They were beaten up, and they were in CIA custody before they came to Guantanamo. And the defense attorneys believe that the CIA still has its fingers on the button of that court or interfering in the
right.
case. I mean, there's reason to believe that. You know, at one point years ago, when in the 9/11 case, one of the attorneys for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man accused of masterminding the 9/11 attack, was talking about the CIA black sites. Somehow, someone outside the court reached in and hit a mute button. And the judge was beside himself. He thought it was his court. And he full stop held a series of hearings and ordered whoever is this body out there that's interfering with my court, disconnect your button. So there's been a series of things that have happened that have caused the defense attorneys to wonder exactly how independent this court is of the CIA.
Wow. Look, Carol Rosenberg, while we have you, we were thinking we'd just do an update on Guantanamo and then all of this USS Cole case information broke. But just give us a quick update. President Trump said during his State of the Union that he'd sign an executive order keeping it open, directing his Secretary of Defense to house any kind of terrorist they find, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, which would be a new population. You've just returned from a reporting trip. Has it changed?
So President Trump campaigned with two promises. He was going to load it up with bad dudes, and he was going to cut the costs of this extremely expensive enterprise to peanuts. And he has done neither. There has not been a single new detainee sent there, and it's still incredibly expensive to run. The latest request by the Pentagon for construction down there is well over $100 million. In fact, there are 41 detainees there today, one of whom was supposed to actually go back to Saudi Arabia last month to finish a prison sentence under a deal that was made during the Obama administration. And the Pentagon has yet to make good on that deal. He was supposed to go back to Saudi Arabia on February 20th, and he sits there waiting to see what's happened. This was a man who was an Al-Qaeda member who turned government informant and pleaded guilty 4 years ago in exchange for his testimony in some of the cases and certain return on February 20th. And he sits there waiting to see what this administration is going to do. There's very little change on the ground that you can notice. There's 1,700 guards and civilian contractors working at that detention center. It's a very expensive, very complicated enterprise to maintain, and any sort of efficiencies that he promised have yet to be realized.
41 detainees, 1,700 U.S. workers there. Carol Rosenberg of the Miami Herald, who's covered the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay for a while now. Carol, thank you.
Thank you.
The war in Syria continues this week with a battle by Turkish troops to capture the Kurdish-held city of Afrin. The United Nations says there have been numerous casualties and significant displacement of civilians. Meanwhile, in this country, many advocates are trying to figure out how to stir up interest and compassion for Syrian refugees. One San Francisco Bay Area theater company has an idea that involves two onions, a quarter cup of pine nuts, and 1 pound of beef. Rachel Miro of KQED reports.
The scene is a kitchen in a private Palo Alto home. Two dozen people are sitting in fold-out chairs in the breakfast nook, a couple feet away from actress Noor El-Samahi, the star of this one-woman show called Oh, My Sweet Land. She plays a Syrian-German woman who relates, over the hum of the kitchen fan, the story of her affair with a Syrian refugee while she cooks kibbeh, fried bulgur wheat balls filled with meat and spices. Recipes vary regionally, but they're popular throughout the Middle East.
In the recipes, they say, take an onion. What kind of an onion? Big? Small? An onion is not a unit of measurement. It's like saying, take a man. But which man?
She never gives her name, but we learn a lot about kibbeh.
Wheat, meat, heat. Syria.
It's the character's re-entry point back into the Syrian half of her heritage. She entices a handsome Syrian into her apartment with kibbeh. Later on, when she travels to Lebanon to look him up again, she finds that sharing food with guests is one way the people there cling to their humanity in the midst of a civil war. Wait, you say, did I just say Lebanon? Yes, most of the 5.5 million Syrians who fled their country settled just over the border in Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan.
Every vacant space is now a shelter for the refugees. Every shop or storage room has been rented out. Every room is now shared by many families.
After the play, audience members are invited to hang out, eat Syrian food, and discuss what they've just seen. The smell of spices like cumin and sumac coming to life as they fry in sizzling oil is a way of transcending the walls people build between cultures. It's also impossible to look away when El-Samahi is 2 feet away, telling you about children killed in chemical weapons attacks. So says Jennifer Pien of Menlo Park.
It's just such a contrast, the warmth and the security that we have, juxtaposed with what our characters have gone through. Yeah, it's visceral.
Like the Syrian refugees, Oh My Sweet Land has no fixed address. It plays in kitchens, restaurants, and community spaces put on by Golden Thread Productions, a Northern California theater company that focuses on Middle Eastern stories. Actress El-Samahi, who, by the way, is half Egyptian, says she hopes Oh My Sweet Land encourages people to take action while it makes a difference.
You know, so this is a way to generate conversation, and I also have a kid, and is he going to ask me in 15 years, what did you do? You know, and I don't have that answer. I mean, I donate money. We don't, you know, we all have our causes, but I don't want to shut down. That's why we do this work.
One batch of kibbeh at a time. For Here and Now, I'm Rachel Myra.
An openly gay high school football player in St. Louis got support from his classmates earlier this week after the Westboro Baptist Church showed up to protest him. Supporters used the hashtag #StandWithJake, Jake being Jake Bain, a senior at John Burroughs, a private prep school in St. Louis. And Jake Bain joins us now. Jake, thank you for being here, and I'm sure it's been an interesting week for you. Tell us more about what happened on Monday with the protest and the counter-protest.
Around 7:30 is when the Westboro Baptist Church started rolling in. And by that point, there was probably already 200 people that were outside with all kinds of signs in support of my community and in support of the LGBT community as a whole. In the morning in our auditorium, we had a bunch of student speakers come and talk to us, both speakers who were from the LGBT community and also people who were just allies of the community. And then we had an alumni video that a whole bunch of alumni sent in from all different classes. Like, the oldest class was, I think, 1958.
So incredibly proud to be a Burroughs alum, now more than ever. Love always wins. I stand with Jake.
I stand with Jake because I believe people should be valued for their contributions to society and not denigrated for how they were born. Thank you, Jake Bain, for standing strong.
Hey, Jake. This is Chinay Du, former Burroughs bomber, sending you love from Los Angeles. You are put on this earth to do everything you're doing right now. Stay strong, and I hope you feel all the love from everywhere.
Just wanted to say that I'm really proud of you guys for the way that you're sticking together and really supporting each other in the thick of adversity. Jake, man, your courage is unrivaled, dude. You got more courage than I had as a teenager, and it is an honor to stand with you.
So there was alumni from everywhere that were able to send in really supportive messages, so that was really great. And then just to go outside and just get to see all the amazing support, it was really special.
And a lot more supporters of you than members of the Westboro Baptist Church?
Absolutely. I mean, I would say they were probably outnumbered 3-1.
Why do you think they targeted you?
I think they targeted me because they saw that that a gay athlete was in the news and for the past couple weeks. And I think they honestly, they got a little scared that people are starting to realize that it doesn't really matter if you're gay and that everybody should be treated equally. And so I think they kind of realize that the tides are changing, and as this generation and the next generations to come continue to grow and learn, I think more and more people are becoming accepting. And so I think that goes against everything that they stand for. So I think they've been trying to suppress any kind of person that wants to step out and show that you can be whoever you want to be. So I think that's the kind of the main reason why they decided to come after me.
Did it surprise you that they did?
Honestly, yeah, it did a little bit at first because I didn't realize that my story had gotten that big. Because, I mean, I know, like, I've always seen Westboro Baptist Church in the news protesting big events and things like that. So to hear that they were actually going to come to my school was pretty shocking to me.
The reason that you are so well known for being openly gay there is because you actually came out to your entire school last fall during a school assembly. Tell us what you did there and why.
So for National Coming Out Week, I'm one of the leaders of our club called Spectrum, which is the LGBT club at Burroughs, where it's basically just a support group for the LGBT community. And so we, for National Coming Out Week, we wanted to do something special in assembly. So we had a lot of people, if they wanted to, they could send in kind of like their coming out story or what it means for them to not be able to come out. And these were all read anonymously. And then for the last speech, I decided that I wanted to write a speech that was basically just for the kids who really weren't able to come out yet and they didn't feel comfortable in our community, because it really is an open community where everyone can be whoever they want to be. So I wanted to show people that and show people that it's okay to live your life however you want to and to not worry about what other people might think of you just because of your sexuality. So I think that was kind of my main message there, was to be somebody that the younger kids could look up to, because I know that when I was growing up, I never really had somebody that I could relate to and that was going through the same things that I was. So I wanted to kind of make sure that the next generation of kids had that person.
In a lot of the stories about you, the headline includes the phrase, an openly gay football player. Do you think the fact that you are an athlete changes how your story is viewed?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's kind of the reason why my story has gotten big, is because there aren't really many openly gay athletes in college sports, and especially not in football. So I think the fact that more people are starting to realize that really anybody can be gay, there's no like set rules as to what you have to do if you're gay. Obviously, people have their stereotypes, but there's not really one set of, like, there's not one type of gay. So, I mean, it showed a lot of people that, like, more and more people are becoming comfortable. And I just wanted to show that, like, playing sports and being gay, those two things can go together.
Has anything scared you about this whole experience?
I think my biggest fear has been that people will see this as just a special situation, and they won't realize that this is going on everywhere around the country. There's so many kids that are having to deal with the same things that I have to deal with, who may not get as much recognition, or their story may never be heard. So this is so much bigger than just me. It's just so many people out there that are going through the same things that I'm going through. So I just hope that a light is kind of shed on the entire community, especially of the youth.
I understand you've committed to go to Indiana State University to play football next year. What do you hope to do next?
Yeah, I mean, going to Indiana State is going to be really special. I mean, football has been my passion for as long as I can remember. I've been playing since I was 11 years old. So, I mean, it's always been my dream to go on and to play Division I football. So the fact that I've kind of been able to fulfill that dream has really been special for me.
Do you think the people at Burroughs at your high school are going to remember you for this, for what just happened this week, or for other things?
I think I've been able to kind of leave a legacy of just the fact that really anything's possible. You can build your own path, especially coming from Burroughs. I mean, Burroughs is such a unique environment where there's been so many people that have come out of Burroughs to do great things in life. So I think the legacy that I'll leave is kind of just overall to show kids that you can really be whoever you want to be and to not really worry about that. I mean, I think I've been able to leave a legacy both on the football field and also just around the classroom and around our community as a whole. So I think it's been pretty special.
You think the Westboro Baptist Church is going to be back?
I don't know. I mean, I think after all the support that they saw, they now realize that this is a community that isn't going to take any hate, and we're not going to stand for people who are going to try to come after people of our own community. Because not only Burroughs, but the entire St. Louis community came out to show their support. So I don't know if they will actually come back. I mean, I know a lot of the thing, like you hear a lot of from the people who were saying that maybe we shouldn't have counter protesters because you don't want to give attention to the Westboro Baptist Church. So maybe they'll see that as an opportunity to try to spread their word, and maybe they will be back. But I mean, I think it's important to whenever there is a group of hate, like a hate group like this, it is important to make sure that everybody knows that we don't stand for this, and that we do have people that are willing to come out and show their support for our community.
That's Jake Bain, who is a senior and openly gay football player at John Burroughs School in St. Louis, where there was a Westboro Baptist Church protest of him this week and then a counter-protest with the hashtag StandWithJake. Jake, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
He studied the furthest reaches of space and time, and from a wheelchair became one of the biggest stars in our galaxy. But Stephen Hawking, it turns out, was mortal after all. He died this morning at 76. He was diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, when he was just 21, losing control over everything but one finger and those eyes, through which he saw things we couldn't, then explain them to us in books like A Brief History of Time. He redefined how we understand black holes and gravity. He was also on The Simpsons. What a life. Laura Mersini Houghton is a cosmologist and theoretical physicist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and was a friend. So, Professor Laura, sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a loss for all of us, I think.
And remind us why. So many accomplishments. What would you put at the top of the list?
The top of the list, of course, would be Hawking radiation, the fact that black holes are not black, and that is probably biggest discovery, although there is a long list of contributions that he made to science. But on top of that, he also did great service to society by bringing science into the public eye. And at the same time, he took a very keen interest in politics and society. For example, this year, the last battle he fought and that he won was trying to protect the National Health Service in the UK. So I might have to disagree with you on the mortality part. He did start his career in science as a mere mortal, but I think we all agree that that career never ended.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned black holes and his 1974 thesis, Black Hole Explosions. He explained particles could escape black holes, that they had heat. And he did apologize to science fiction fans, saying you can't, you know, travel to new places by jumping into them. So he had that way of sort of, you know, speaking to science fiction fans and elite academics. You mentioned his battle to keep the health service in Britain, which had helped him. How did you communicate with him, though? We know he used an electronic voice with an American accent, you know, only working at 15 words a minute. What was it like to converse with him?
That was the most special part of getting to know someone as special as Stephen, because he was capable of putting a whole difficult concept in just one sentence and with such clarity that it would take at least one paragraph to anyone else. So once, of course, you get past the initial intimidation of being in the presence of such a great scientist, then from then on it was not difficult communicating with him.
You mentioned, I think, some of his incorrigibleness. He ruffled feathers. Leonard Susskind of Stanford once called him the most infuriating person in the universe, to which Hawking grinned. Talk about that side of him.
Well, Stephen, of course, continued throughout his life to work on the problem of black holes and Hawking radiation. Even 2 years ago, we organized a conference together on this topic in Stockholm. And, of course, his doctor was very much against him traveling. But Stephen was pretty determined, and once he had set his mind into something, nobody could stop him. So this kind of strong-headedness made him a very, very special person.
Many of us have known people and loved people who've been lost to ALS. He lived so long with it. Did he explain why or how?
The closest I ever got to a more insider's understanding of this problem was when in this conference in Stockholm that we organized together. We were deciding what music to have at the banquet of the conference, and I suggested Beethoven's Opus 131, which is that part of Beethoven's contribution when he was completely deaf and blind, and Stephen smiled and he said, "No, we must have Opus 132," and that was very telling because there is a very subtle difference between 131 and 132, and that lies in the combination of hopelessness of being victim to a certain disease in one hand and that willpower that sees you victorious at the end independently.
Oh, wonderful. Laura Mersini-Houghton, cosmologist, theoretical physicist, friend of the late Stephen Hawking. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
And we leave you with the words of Stephen Hawking.
I have spent my life traveling across the universe. Inside my mind. Through theoretical physics, I have sought to answer some of the great questions. But there are other challenges, other big questions which must be answered, and these will also need a new generation who are interested, engaged, and with an understanding of science. How will we feed an ever-growing population, provide clean water, generate renewable energy, prevent and cure disease, and slow down global climate change? I hope that science and technology will provide the answers to these questions, but it will take people, human beings with knowledge and understanding, to implement these solutions.
And the Beethoven, 132, not 131. Go further. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.